Today on the Zulu One podcast, we have a game changer. He has been a youth education and human development specialist for more than 35 years and is currently serving as the executive director of the nationally recognized grassroots movement known as the Circle of Brotherhood, Brother Lyle Muhammad. How are you, sir?
I am fine, as I always say, by his grace. I'm well. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Honor's mine, good brother.
I'm really excited about doing this. I've been following you guys for about 3 years, mm-hmm. you know, since you guys did the hunger strike.
Yes, sir.
And just really following your guys' movement and wanted to reach out, and I didn't really know how, and finally got in touch with Mr. Albert.
Right.
And then through that, you know, started contacting him and invited him to do a workshop, mm-hmm. and then invited you to do a workshop. Awesome. And one of the things I wanted to say before kind of we started is that how grateful I am and how in awe I am of your guys' courage to just kind of this stranger out of nowhere to come in and just be open to that opportunity. So it's just... I don't know. There's not many things that are more encouraging to me than that. It's just people's openness to explore new horizons. So I really want to say thank you for that.
Well, the honor is ours. And to be truthful, the openness, it doesn't come with a blindness.
Yeah.
It comes with understanding that there are many, many, many spirits, many, many, many individuals, many, many pathways that are destined to cross. Mm. And sometimes you have to go with your inner guidance more so than an outer protocol. So we try to be what I call God led and God fed. So
yeah, that's huge. That's really, I can't, you know, I've got buddies of mine, right? That I used to be in the military, and I've got buddies of mine, and it's, you know, they're like, you tell them anything and they're like, oh, I don't want to do anything. And just the fact that you guys did that is really inspiring. You know, the fact that you guys were just completely open to doing that. And I was just blown away by your courage. I mean, that's, you know, to go into some space like that completely, you know, vulnerable is really courageous. And that brought me into kind of my next question is like, how did you guys get into the Circle of Brotherhood idea, the idea of kind of men leading this and the vulnerability that you guys have and the group, like how did that, where did that come from?
Right. I really have to start with where the meditation started. If I'm to be completely honest about vision, that all of us who call ourselves members of the Circle of Brotherhood, we come from various paths. Mm. Various struggles, of course, some collective, some individual. We come from different places in terms of geography, different family histories and backgrounds. But all of us were born in a time, in a space that was purposeful. Mm. And so now to get to the more tangible part of that, it was maybe about 2012.
Okay.
Where, you know, we've been doing work in our communities for many, many years, some in silos, sometimes together. But in this particular case, there was an individual. Many people are familiar with it's a television show, which, by the way, I call Tell Live Vision, just for the record.
Yeah.
And First 48. And they do lifetime homicide investigations and so forth. And they spent a lot of time in Miami.
Yeah.
And Liberty City and Overtown, mm-hmm. and Detective Ford at that time, who I believe now is retired from the police department. He saw a rash of murders that were taking place, particularly in Liberty City.
Okay.
And what bothered him about it, he'd been doing homicide for 27 years. I want to pause there and say, just think about it. First of all, think about being an officer doing homicide investigations for 27 years.
Oh.
In
I could imagine.
Some of the most violent ridden neighborhoods in Miami. But this particular time, what caught his attention is how quickly they were becoming cold cases. It stirred him so much that he went, had a meeting with a sitting commissioner at that time, Commissioner Michelle Spence Jones. And once he revealed to her what he was dealing with, her response to him was, well, I don't know what to do, but I know who to call.
Okay.
So she called. It wasn't many of us. She called about five of us together. Some of us were meeting for the first time. Some of us knew of each other's work, kind of, you know, never really having done anything together. But after, at that time, again, Detective Ford's presentation, we made a promise to ourselves that we would never, ever again allow our differences or things that disunite us to be more prevalent than what we can do together and what unites us.
Wow, that's powerful.
And that's the genesis that gave birth to the Circle of Brotherhood.
Oh, wow. Wow. So you guys were individually doing stuff in the community as, you know, like different organizations, and this Detective Ford having this presentation, and was it the city commissioner that got involved,
right,
brought you all together and said, hey, let's do this as a team and let's move forward.
Right. And we made a promise to ourselves on how we would build that.
Man, that's cool.
And it should be noted that one of the greatest traumas suffered in our communities is the repetitive cycle of Band-Aid approaches,
yeah,
and then open wounds.
Yeah.
The repetitive cycle of historical,
yeah,
traumas.
Traumas, yeah, absolutely. Right?
And I mention that because it's important for people to know that one of the greatest traumas that has incurred in our communities is division.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Division.
Yeah.
And when a people are disunited, there's nothing they can accomplish.
Absolutely.
And so it was a big deal for us coming together.
Yeah, I would
imagine. You know, from many different walk of life.
Mm.
Some of us were Muslim.
Yeah.
Some were Christian.
Yeah.
Some practiced other cultural and ethnic backgrounds,
yeah,
and whether it be religions or ways of life.
Yeah.
Some of us are from what they call the streets.
Yeah.
Some of us have spent double-digit years in prison, and others have never seen the back of a police car before.
Yeah.
All working together. But we made a promise to ourselves in terms of starting that we wouldn't make any promises. One of our models comes from a great, great revolutionary from Guinea-Bissau by the name of Amilcar Cabral. He says, tell no lies and claim no easy victories.
Yeah.
And so we said, first, we must become brothers.
Yeah.
It's not about us coming together to, the idea wasn't to build an organization.
Yeah.
The idea wasn't any of that, but to first become brothers. And so we started meeting every Saturday for an hour.
Okay.
In what was called the hotspot of the violence.
Okay.
Right in the center of Liberty Square. And we would exercise.
Really?
We would exercise.
Wow.
We do some breathing and some stretching exercises, some light calisthenics, you know, a little positive exchange of words, and then we would walk the neighborhood.
Okay.
And as we were getting to know the residents, we were getting to know each other. And then that began to turn into a, for lack of a better word here in Miami, a snowball of activity that led into the birth of what we now call the Circle of Brotherhood.
It seems like it started with an assumption of responsibility, almost. It's like, this is ours, and I'm going to assume the responsibility of my community, right? I mean, not as much as a detailed responsibility, but like a general sense of responsibility. It's like, this is ours, and we're going to do something about it, right?
Well, I think we already had those qualities and characteristics, so that was never, ever, ever a question.
Yeah.
But something about just being aware of the time and the need, not just for us to do something together, but to be more prevalent, the need for Black men to be seen in a positive light, loving and solving their problems in our own communities.
Wow, that's huge. And so it starts with you guys exercising at Liberty Square, right? And then you guys walking the community. And so how does that evolve into, like, does the exchange, you guys are engaging with people, walking around the community, does that evolve?
Well, what was rooted in the core of all of our participation was love.
Mm.
And if you look at coals, for example, you know, a coal can get very, 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 very hot.
Yeah.
But if you put it with other coals, it generates a whole different kind of heat.
Yeah.
So now you have all these loving, caring, concerned Black men in a community that's been void of the presence.
Yeah.
For many reasons.
Yeah.
Intentional incarceration rates and plans, health disparities. I can go on and on and on and
Absolutely.
On in terms of that. But can you imagine being a mother or being a child and not used to being in the presence of that kind of love from where you need it the
Absolutely.
Most? And then you witness it. So the children would begin to come up.
I couldn't imagine.
And we would build relationships with them.
That's
and we started
huge.
Doing activities for the children.
Oh, wow.
People would start coming out and talking to us and, need resources. So we started giving resources to people. And then we begin to have a brotherhood that was genuinely built. It became structured and organized as we begin to have monthly breakfasts.
Okay.
To go along with the meeting every week.
Okay.
And then the ideas of the great minds of the men of the circle of brotherhood begin to manifest in doing things together. And then one thing led to another in terms of our formalization. But it should be noted that we have been primarily a volunteer organization since 2012. We didn't receive any real significant funding even to staff ourselves till about a year and a half ago.
Really?
That's correct.
Wow. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a resilient, what a resilient movement that you guys, and just, a lot of people, a lot of things kind of, flame out, right? And it's just the consistency of being there every Saturday, weekly basis and building the community. And what have you guys, what impact have you guys seen that you guys have been able to kind of accomplish in the neighborhood?
Got it. I'm going to take it from a macro into a micro. It was about 2 years ago, 2018, where we were contacted by a national organization that works with Black male achievement. And they been in existence for about 10 years and building what they call promise communities across the country. And they've been in certain cities. And they measure, it's almost like a barometer of activity for Black male involvement in the different cities. And they notice that in this particular time period, that out of nowhere, this activity in Miami is what we call on the upcrease, as one of my good mentors used to say. and that increase was so significant that they invited us to participate in their national conference.
Oh, wow.
And that really began to allow us, because remember, we didn't set out to make any benchmarks. We didn't set out. Don't get me clear, men of very clear vision in every aspect of life and human development. And community development and economic development.
Yeah.
But it was still that concept of just becoming brothers. And so when we realized that kind of impact, and then we saw that what we were doing was really needed in every single urban community across this country.
Yeah.
And so we began to, formalize what we were doing through training. We've always done training. That's been one of the cornerstones. One of our models is self-improvement is the basis for community development. So we're always working on self. Even when we were doing those exercise circles, and now I'm going down to the micro, to the community.
Yeah.
One of our sayings is that exercise to the body is like study to the mind, like prayer to the soul.
Okay.
When we have all three, we become whole. So we've always addressed the whole man. And so the community's response is overwhelming. And I must say, overwhelming on every level. I'll take a quote from still now the sitting public defender in Miami-Dade County, Carlos Martinez. Now, he's been in office for 27, 28 years. And he said, the circle of brotherhood has become one of the most well-known and respected community-based organizations in all of Dade County. Now, mind you, we've only been in existence, technically, if you will, since 2012, but formalized just over the last year, staffing ourselves. So what I mean is the uniqueness about it is that we have a deep respect from the street all the way to the halls of government on every level. from the children that we work with, the mothers of those children, the men who finally found something they can come and get involved in, yeah. and that is consistent about their personal growth and development along with our communities, having resources.
Yeah.
I'll put it to you this way. In that small amount of time, we were able to acquire a 58,000 square foot facility, yeah. a former elementary school.
Yeah.
And just to kind of show you the kind of things people will do when they see you doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
You know, so Dr. Dorothy Bendros Mendigo, the school board played a key role in the building going to the county so the county could lease it to us, for $1 a year.
Yeah.
And we're bringing in, it's not just about us. Yeah. That same philosophy that we have as an organization, we're bringing in other organizations that do that same type of grounded community work too. Yeah. So we are well respected from the streets.
Yeah.
All the way to the halls of government.
Yeah. I saw that. That's where I met Mr. Albert over there.
Okay.
And he's like, hey, just meet me here. And I just came in. I was like, this is super cool. It's the, you have the, economic development side and you have the entrepreneur empowerment side and then the circle of brotherhood. It's just like, that seems like any successful formula to be able to say, lift up the community and say, let's get this going again, right? It's like really empowering from the inside out, right? Is to say, this is like this plant that's growing that's going to be super fruitful. So
it's something important to say about that particular facility and about our work as the Circle of Brotherhood. Many people have heard it said before that nothing can stop an idea whose time has come.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And when you look at how the resources came together to support our work, different individuals in the Circle of Brotherhood who have played key cornerstone roles, sacrificing their own personal finances in their own organizational institutions. Mind you, we're talking about bringing together men that in their own right, they have their own businesses or they're running their own organizations and all of us collectively together. But the spirit of how that building came together says it all. For example, a couple of things that are there. We have a butterfly garden.
Okay.
That's right in the middle. And how the butterfly garden came to be is there was an organization that does urban gardening that had a grant but had nowhere to put it.
Okay.
And then, of course, people said, you can't have butterflies. They won't come there. But there's a butterfly garden there and there's butterflies there now.
Yeah.
We have a $100,000 workout center at our facility there that was donated by another foundation, the Milton Foundation, for that. And I'm just mentioning these things because as all of that comes together, we begin to have the resources.
Yeah,
we have to be crystal clear about something. There have always been black men in our communities that had the vision and knew exactly what needed to be done to stabilize our homes and our communities.
Yeah.
Economically, socially, you name it. But we haven't always had the resources.
Absolutely.
And so now when you see us coming together and at the same time now being able to get the resources to do the work, it really helps to magnify what we can do.
Do you think timing had anything to do with it? Like the timing and social media?
Has everything to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm going to use a micro example about something that happened just a few months ago, just short of the pandemic. I got to get the timing right. No, as a matter of fact, I think we were into the pandemic because, yes, we're having masks at what I'm getting ready to describe. There was an incident that took place in Miami-Dade County. We do a lot of work with the police department in terms of training and helping to transform their view, our view, all of that. And there was a woman, a Latino woman, who killed her child and gave a police report that her child was killed by two black men in a particular neighborhood. Miami-Dade Police Department, they sniffed it out. And, Director Ramirez, I give him credit. He came out right away, and made a statement about that. But so we were going to do a press conference on the need for these relationships to be proved. That's a very damaging thing, and what could have transpired. Sure. 2 or 3 days before our press conference, the George Floyd incident takes place. But our press conference was already scheduled to take place. So now you can imagine the light that is now on our press conference as opposed to, and I'm only using that because of timing. Timing brings focus. Timing brings attention. I use timing in this way too. Timing is a roadmap. You know, and if you're on the right road at the wrong time, you might as well be in the wrong place. So, but timing has a lot to do with it. And one other thing I think too, and that's relationships. I think the greatest key to our success on every level has been because of relationships. I'll give you an example. Our lead organizer, Leroy Jones, he has some of the most profound and respected relationships with a cross-section of politicians, judges, and people in the economic arena across the span of race, ethnicity, business interests, you name it. But they respect him so much that the integrity that he brings to our organization allows them to give us the same kind of respect. We have individuals in our organization that used to tear our communities up. And you know, in the hood, you know, when you get a rep for being the baddest of the bad, people know who you are. And they remember you. But then now when they see you transformed and they see you building your community.
That's huge.
The type of respect that they have. So the respect level for who we are and what we do, I think it may be unprecedented. As a whole. I know other people in communities have experienced it, but I think there's something different about what's going on right now.
That's one of the reasons I was so drawn to it. It was like, there's something here that is extraordinarily powerful and that's needed. And that's been needed for generations. I mean, this isn't a now problem. This is a generational problem that we're all part of systemically. So going back to what you were saying a little bit about relationships, how have you guys, as the organization, grown the relationship with your local, you know, law enforcement? How is that? I can't be an easy dynamic to navigate, right? How do you guys get them involved and understanding, and how does that relationship work?
I'll start first by looking at the core relationships of the organization, because it has a lot to do with it. I'll give you an example. Our president, Pastor Jeffrey Mack, you know, who's also one of our founding members that was at that original meeting that I talked about. You know, he caught a lot of flack from the Christian community because he was working with so-called other than Christian. He was working with Muslims and you know, but he withstood that. And here's where I'm getting to. When we have the fiber to withstand opposition to what's true and what's good, we're going to win. And so we're an organization and representing our communities that, again, in building relationships, years ago, when we formalized ourselves, one of the very first things we did was call a meeting with the different police chiefs and different directors. Years ago. And we did that for twofold reasons. We got issues in our community, you know, and the police department has issues and our community has issues. See, that's the one good thing about the circle of brotherhood. We're not going to point the finger outward without pointing it inward. And so we built a long-standing relationship where we've seen individuals come on the police force and then become majors and captains and lieutenants and chiefs. So you have to build those proper relationships. In terms of the cross-pollination of training, for example, we have a lot to offer as an organization.
I would imagine.
And as individuals.
Yeah.
In both our expertise in human development and training and our life experiences.
Yeah.
And in order for people to take advantage of that, sometimes you have to take advantage of what they have to offer.
Yeah.
So we initially, matter of fact, we're probably the only grassroots organization in the country that has gone through the actual police department's force-on-force training.
Really?
You know, where you go to the little village that they set up, and you put you put on the gun with the dummy bullets and you go through that. We've done maybe four classes there now.
Really?
Four classes of brothers from the street going through that kind of training. And so we were willing to go through their training. So, you know, they were willing to go through our training. And once you have a training experience, see, our philosophy.
Wow, that gave me goosebumps. I got man, you. That's you wild. Know,
our philosophy as an organization is based on community wellness. Mm. And when you look at the concept of community wellness, there has to be transformation.
Yeah.
So we don't have programs and we have experiences to be transformational. So those officers and what they had to say and their testimonies and coming through our training, they would spend a whole day with us, you know, and our training, it cannot be compared to, you know, the implicit bias training, the sensitivity training. We don't even attach those names to it because it's much more of an experience for those who participate in it. And so the training has become so successful that certain of those departments, we work now with North Miami Police Department, Miami-Dade, the City of Miami, the City of Miami Gardens. Chief Press down in Key Biscayne is a great supporter of the work that we do.
Oh, wow.
And so some of them now, their officers can't come into our communities until they go through our training.
Really?
Right. But now to put the real picture on it, though, the training that we do with the police, we label it as 101.
Okay.
So there's a lot more that needs to be done. Let's be clear about that.
So what is the 101 kind of like? Can you give me a 10,000 foot view of kind of what the general strokes of what the 101 looks like?
Right. Imagine a training session where you have police officers in the same training session with former, whether you want to call them criminals, ex-cons, you know, all together in the same training session. And in that training session, first of all of our trainings deal with the individual first.
Yeah.
So every human being is taking a deep dive into themselves.
Wow. Yeah.
And as every human being is not only taking a deep dive into themselves, we set an atmosphere in our training that allows an individual to be comfortable enough to be expressive and to be open-minded to receive as well as to give. One of the things that we've gathered in our experience in transformational training is that there are many tools, many techniques, many practices, many sciences. And those of us who do them well, we borrow from many.
Yeah.
And it's not that one is better than the other. But, you know, when you have a toolkit and if it's working, you keep working that tool.
Yeah.
So we have transformative experiences and police officers come out and we deal with everything in those trainings from personal trauma that individuals have gone through in their life to understanding the difference between cultural realities of people who live in a place versus work in a place.
Mm.
We go all the way back to the core root of race relations.
Yeah.
In those particular.
I couldn't imagine.
It's been a great experience.
Man, I can't imagine how transformative and empowering it is to create those. I used to have a boss that would say, you know, she would send us on wild goose chases, mm-hmm. right? So she would say, go find this information. Right. And on the way to the information, you'd go with a team and you would create these peripheral relationships and you'd pick up things along the way. And she would say the answer is almost not as important as what you pick up along the way. And that seems what you guys are doing effectively.
Right. Because when you build effective relationships, see, one of the things, for example, that the pandemic and right on the heels of the pandemic, the worldwide, particularly United States of America, civil unjust, with those things happening in the same space, every silo of every community, you know, along with a tenuous election, if you put that into the mix. So every segment of society has been activated.
Oh, yeah.
But as individuals have been activated, from what I've seen, from the most part, most people have been activated in the silo of their personal interests. Mm. So politicians addressed the pandemic and the civil unrest and the election from a political perspective.
Yeah.
Doctors addressed it. And not that people shouldn't address their expertise, but when you become blind to the fact that you're only promoting your own, you're not seeing the whole picture.
Yeah.
And when you build proper relationships, you begin to understand, you know, we have allies in every walk of life. There are doctors who are allies against the medical abuses.
Yeah.
There are police officers who are allies of the abuses and the atrocities inside of police departments.
Yeah.
And if you don't build proper relationships, you never get a chance to work with those allies.
Yeah.
And if we're serious about solving our community problems, we have to work in collaborative circles.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things you asked earlier that has led to the growth of our organization.
Yeah.
We're willing and open to collaborate with anyone that wants to do anything of good for our community.
Yeah. That's you. I mean, I don't know. You probably can't pinpoint where that came from, but that's a blessing in itself. It's just the ability for you guys to be open to that collaboration and just anything that comes, you guys are so receptive. And that's really what blows my mind.
It's leadership.
It's leadership. Exactly.
It's leadership.
And it's the vulnerability. It's the courage to be vulnerable as well. It's to say, you know, this and what you were saying in the toolkit, I was like, you know, I have this tool with the workshops. And I was like, you know, this is just a tool. It can be used for it can, you know, you can use a screwdriver to try to hammer things and it's not going to work, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can use a screwdriver to screw in screws and it's going to be very effective to do that. So that's kind of where that came from. I was like, hey, I've got this little thing and it could be part of your guys' toolkit. And because I don't know how familiar you are with kind of like the systemic view of the constellation side, and I'll go into it a little bit. It's the idea is that trauma is inherited from generations. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the basic premise of it, and that there's a collective kind of knowledge and things, right, in family systems. And so if you see that in a community, especially in the Black community, you say the abuses and the atrocities that happened during slavery are still present in today.
Absolutely.
And until those things are resolved, these patterns are going to continue to happen. And that's kind of the thing that draw me, you know, was drawing me to this and say, okay, here's this tool that can resolve that and resolve that piece, because it's one of the pieces of this, right? And it can work in concert with everything else. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I was like so excited when you and Mr. Howard came. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is moving in the right direction. And it's like, at least you guys have seen this and seen the power of it and seeing how this can help provide tools.
Right. It's a lot of critical things about what you shared in that. And first, just in dealing with individuals tied to systemic atrocities or events that produce trauma.
Yeah.
Even in our approach to problem solving, we use an approach that we call social epidemiology.
Okay.
You know, which means that if you have an individual that is sick or ill, you put around that individual what is needed to heal the individual.
Yeah.
You diagnose. Now, if that individual collectively with other individuals are all experiencing the same things, those patterns lead to not just an individual sickness or disease, but a social one.
100%. Yeah.
And so I do a lot of study and practice in trauma training and in healing. And first I'll say that we fight a war on two fronts. We fight on a war front where we, as those of us who are practitioners, and you can be a practitioner just by aiding or assisting another human being. It doesn't have to be something that you actually do. I just wanted to say that for the record.
Yeah.
But we as practitioners, we have to get ultimately individuals that we are seeking to help to explore their trauma in a world that teaches them not to. to.
Yeah.
In a so-called social and psychological conditioning.
Of course.
That goes against the reverse of what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And then there's a war on another front. Because as society has come to realize that trauma is passed down from generation to generation, we also now have to show that so can healing be passed down.
But
not without getting to the root cause.
Absolutely.
So when I'm dealing with an individual, for example, one of the things that becomes clear to me is that if you don't deal with the root traumatic incident or cause or effect, because experience has shown me, in whatever language you want to put it in, that trauma episodes link on to episodes before them.
Yeah.
I just imagine like a spring. That spring has an origin and it just continues to link on and it doesn't go anywhere. And so the impact of multiple traumas in that individual are empowered by every trauma it previously experienced.
Yeah.
However, if we can get to the root cause of that trauma, we literally cut the ability for trauma to link on and even build almost like an immune system, if you will.
Absolutely.
A human being that, I won't say that that can be resilient to trauma, but that can understand and have a DNA and a makeup to survive and get through and get out of it.
Yeah.
What we're supposed to get out of it.
Yeah.
So when you talk about slavery, we have to understand that even though it's 2020, we live in a country that has not as a whole even come to terms with the grips of the reality that journey has had on all of us. And that it is the root cause of the dissension of human relationships in our country and on our planet today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You couldn't have said it better. That's the, you know, it's, I wanted to, one of the things that you said before is so systemic. Like what, there's systemic principles that you're talking about. And one of the systemic principles is that out of loyalty to belong to our family system, we resist, we maintain the system as is, right? Out of loyalty to say, I love this family so much, or I'm so loyal to my mother or to my father or to my grandfather or to my ancestors that I'll take on this burden. And so the kind of the interesting part about it is that like we carry a load for somebody that doesn't belong to us out of loyalty to maintaining that system. And so we have those, that systemic trauma continue to happen. And until what you were saying is that we're able to cut that spring, we can be the gatekeepers for the future generations.
Wow. You know, you brought to mind some particular work that I've been blessed to do. And I think nothing comes into the atmosphere by accident. And I don't say this to put myself in a particular light, but only in a particular reality. Mm-hmm. You know, since 93 or 94, I've been blessed to be involved in national transformational trainings with that 16 to 24 year old population who was not in school, not in work, you know, incarceration, street gang, you get all of that.
Yeah.
My point being is part of our process in that training, we do a day where we separate the men from the women. And I've been blessed to, for whatever name you want to give it, if you want to call it a healing circle or whatever type, I'm just trying to put an image in someone's head where, in terms of that population of young women, I probably have had more exposure to what they have gone through. You imagine, you know, these circles could be anywhere from 20 to 30 or 40 at a time, you know, and the overwhelming majority, 95% have been abused, in every manner you can think of. And in those sessions, 85 to 90% of it are sharing it for the first time in their life. You know, and I have witnessed that thousands, you're going back to 1994 and up to now with that particular same population of young women across this country in many different states.
Yeah.
And so that experience has taught me a lot. Mm. It's taught me the importance of that initial release.
Yeah.
It's also taught me the importance of creating the sacred space that's necessary for people to open up and reveal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's if you look at it from you know, kind of the generational perspective, right? The systemic lens, as they call it, you can see how those things are passed down from generation to generation to generation. And so you see it also like in, you know, the Holocaust survivor community. People that have survived wars, that have survived genocides, that have survived atrocities in communities. And you can see the patterns that happen in those workshops of the loyalty towards the family systems. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you guys are addressing, that you from that perspective are addressing those things, and these people are releasing those things for the first time, the ripple effects of that healing are very wide.
Two examples.
It's huge.
Two examples. You know, when our nine members went on the hunger strike, the 21.5-day hunger strike with just water, there were students that came down from Parkland. And students came down from Parkland because there was a collective identity about the atrocities that are associated with gun violence.
Yeah.
And now you have urban communities and advocates working with suburban communities and advocates that would have never worked together before, because they recognize the interconnectedness.
Yeah.
One of the things our society has not done, in my perspective, what they have not done, is recognize the similarities in terms of both what happened in terms of the Holocaust and in terms of the transatlantic slave trade and movement. And when you look at both incidents of time, so to speak, one community has been able to keep in the forefront of the mind of society the importance of what they went through, while another is even still struggling to properly identify it.
Absolutely.
And that that means that there's a burden there.
Yeah.
And that burden is not just on those who are still trying to struggle through the atrocities that they have experienced, and to understand it and to be able to diagnose it, even recognize it, let alone heal from it.
Yeah.
Society has a collective responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things when you start talking about race relations, you know, people think that, you know, it's just on a particular, you know, black folk, you, no, that's an issue that's affecting all of us.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and so one of the things I've learned in the training that I do is that if the atmosphere is set properly, humans are able to recognize the humanity in each other.
Yeah. Yeah. That's step number one, right? Like, if you can set the scene for that exchange to happen in a place of understanding, you can, anything can be accomplished, right? And that's so powerful about what your team is putting together, is the plane setting a stage where understanding can happen. And it's interesting that you brought up what happened in Parkland and during the hunger strike, and the similarities between the two things. The thing that systemically what happens is that when that I've seen is that when you can reconcile between the victim and the perpetrator, you can create, that's when you can create profound healing. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I've seen missing sometimes, mm-hmm. is that if the, you know, and many times the generation, what another one of the principles is that victim energy creates perpetrator energy, and then perpetrator energy creates victim energy. And so that's where the cycle continually goes down. It might jump a generation. It might be, you know, like a huge movement that happens from a perpetrator side or from a victim side. And so once you say, once the, like in the circle or in these workshops, you can see that the dynamic between the victim and the perpetrator can be brought together and healed, is when you can release it and it no longer continues, and you can be that gatekeeper for that generation. It's like, that's where the shift, and you get, you know, these goosebumps, huge shift, and it releases. And the and as far as slavery goes in the United States, is that's number one. It's like, hey, I have benefits from the perpetrator and I have benefits from the victim. I have both of these things, and both of these right. energies live inside of me. Mm-hmm. And what can I do to heal those two things together, right? Mm-hmm. And say, because if not, what happens is righteousness happens, right? And then when the righteousness happens, you can judge. And when you can judge, you're tethered to that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And when you can look at it softly, you can have opinion, right? And you can move, and you can have freedom, and you can go away from it or get close to it and look at it and you have a real relationship with it rather right. than a judgment, right? Right. A rigid judgment between those two things.
Now, can you imagine if that type of training, exposure, and experience was involved in our educational system?
Oh.
See.
Yeah, that would be huge.
Because, again, it's a wonderful thing to celebrate the successes that we see in our work. But if we peek up from our work and look out, I'll give you an example. Just this past last Saturday, we hosted a Boys to Men conference for 50 young boys between the ages of 8 and 20 in the foster care system. And in hosting that, in having that experience with them, we can celebrate the powerfulness of what happened on that day and all mm-hmm. of the different things. And I'll never forget at the end of it, one of the persons who runs the foster care agency, you know, and she said, and just think that we have a total of 2,000. So here we are reveling, and rightfully so, in the experiences that were created with this 50. But knowing that there's 2,000 that need the same thing.
Yeah.
And I bring that up because there are bent minds against that type of education.
Yeah.
There are bent minds.
Of course.
There are minds that are actually not just diametrically opposed,
yeah.
but have invested all of their energy, their training, and their yeah. sciences to prove truth to be false.
Absolutely.
What's dangerous about it is that it represents a very powerful segment of those who have control over everything from economics. And if you control economics, then you control cultural and racial relations.
Yeah.
You control
yeah.
all types of things. And so I bring that up to say there's something happening, though.
There's something happening.
There are individuals who are linking yeah. up and joining up who would not have linked up or joined up before. There are, and many people even witnessed during this last wave of civil unrest related to police violence, because we've seen many waves of it and we'll see more. But the point being is that there are individuals who yesterday wouldn't have got involved, but for some reason they got involved today. There yeah. were just different dynamics.
Yeah.
And so it is those of us who are change agents
yeah.
and what needs to take place for human transformation.
Yeah.
But I don't operate in a vacuum. I know socially,
yeah.
you know, that there are realms that are bent completely against
yeah.
what we stand for.
And so that's almost the opposite. So if you look at a system, right, mm-hmm. there's the whole of the system, and then there's the rebels. So the rebels tell you what's wrong with the system, mm-hmm. and then there's the like the people that are the pillars of the system, right? That say mm-hmm. the system needs to stay because when they're so loyal to the system, they say, "Don't change it." Mm-hmm. And so one way to look at the people that mm-hmm. that want to do everything in their power to maintain the system is to say, "Thank you for showing me the power of the system," and say, "Now I understand the perspective of where you're coming from, and then you can change the whole system." When you acknowledge those mm-hmm. that are excluded, mm-hmm. you can change and heal the whole system.
You know, I want to give this, and I consider it to be a gift, you know, and it's a gift from experience. You know, I look at my own personal journey in growth and development and understanding race relations. Mm. And from a child and being completely blind, consciously and unconsciously, to the realities of it, to an elementary school student experiencing it but not really understanding it.
Yeah.
You know, to a middle school student seeing it in my face. In school, seeing it in my face, in church, and now beginning to recognize it in relationships.
Yeah.
But still not understanding the dichotomy of our community and other communities. But then, you know, high school was a shift for me. You know, and I'm kind of traveling down two tracks here because we all have a life track.
Yeah.
And we are where we're supposed to be if we pay attention. And so by the time I was born in a little teeny city called Springfield, Massachusetts. By the time I was 14, I was kicked out of a whole state school system. I couldn't go to any more schools in the state of Massachusetts. They basically threw me away. So my family, we had family in Baltimore. So we moved to Baltimore. And so in my high school experience now, for the first time in my life, I'm around a predominantly black environment. And so I go to college. And now I'm in an environment that is 96% white. And now I really start to experience some outward racism, so to speak. Overt, if you want to call it that. And then in the classroom, the covert and institutional. And you go from an individual when you get exposed to that. And then you get exposed to the reality of who you are versus who you've been identified to be.
Absolutely.
And then you start learning your own history and your own culture, and you pin on all of this back. You go through stages of anger.
Yeah.
And I remember being angry, you know, angry at individuals, angry at systems, angry at society, angry at those that weren't doing anything about it, which ultimately made me angry, of course,
yeah.
at myself. I'm sharing that journey because those of us who stay this walk the course of time, one of my great, great mentors, Dr. John T. Chazelle, he taught a concept he called optimal health. And he said that whenever you look into the universe, everything that you see that is alive is a sign of the power and the ability that you have. And so to tie in what I'm saying is, when you stay the course of doing good, righteous, and needed community and human development work, you grow into a mindset that nothing can stop you from being successful.
Yeah, absolutely.
No society.
Yeah.
And then you begin to focus on what you need to focus on.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm finished being angry.
Yeah.
I don't have time to be angry. I've grown from that. And I'm growing into and continuously growing into other stages and knowing that, you know, I guess it's scriptural. No weapon formed against the righteous will prosper.
Yeah.
But another key element to the example you gave about, you know, the rebels in the system. There are also bees that are inside of the wound.
Yeah.
And they're making honey.
Yeah.
No matter what's going on around them.
Yep.
No matter what this debate is about over here. With this debate is over here, with this, there are bees. And that's one thing I can say about the circle of brotherhood.
Oh, yeah.
Not only are we busy
yeah.
as bees, but we're applying that balm. We're applying that healing. You know, okay, that's the issue. That's the problem. Well, what's the solution? Let's make the balm. And once you yeah. concentrate on just being a balm maker, you know, you can see that, again, no weapon formed against the righteous will prosper.
Have you, going back a little bit to the anger, was it anger of loss, like a almost a loss of what was? Would that make sense? Does that make sense? Like almost like a loss of what was, and seeing the like almost a loss of a world vision that was before, and the growth of that brought you to this place now. That anger was almost the vessel that brought you to this place now, right?
You know, anger is a very needed and necessary emotion.
Yeah.
Very needed. It's almost like in a personal or social sense that change doesn't come until we're dissatisfied.
Yeah.
And it takes 100% dissatisfaction to bring about change. And anger is very, you know, there's a lot of different ways, but in this sense that we're talking about it, it's a necessary step or necessary stage. So I don't ever want people to discount individuals. Why? I had a right to be angry. And however many layers there are on an onion, that's how many levels of abuse.
Of course.
Neglect, biological, chemical, social, economical, structural wise with the family internally,
yeah.
the oppression from the outside,
yeah.
The pressure from the inside and the outside. People have yet really to fathom, particularly in this case, what a black man goes through in attempting to survive and live as a black man, reconcile the healings needed from your past, discover your history and your culture, and yeah. maintain and be responsible for your family and your community.
Yeah.
Void of knowledge and mentors.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
It's impossible.
Do.
Yeah, it's impossible to do. Something's gotta give.
Yeah.
There has to be a place where there's an opening, right? And it seems whatever you guys are doing is creating that opening, and that just have you ever heard of Dr. Jordan Peterson?
No.
He's a Canadian psychologist, okay. and he talks about how little encouragement people need.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit of encouragement. Mm-hmm. He talks about how in awe he is of people when just a little bit of encouragement will take them,
right.
help them grow and bounds.
Excellent, excellent point. You know, I had an opportunity to work at a community center in Miami called the Overtown Youth Center.
Yeah.
And it ran off of a philosophy that understood that. Just to give you an example, you know, the data says that in many of our communities, young people receive 16 negative touches or responses before they receive one positive. So just do the math on that for a minute. That means, you know, you wake up in the morning and before you hear anything good, everything that you're hearing is negative. And then you try to escape it. So you turn on a controlled radio or music environment, and now you're getting more negative.
Yeah.
And then you have the negative energy in the household because everybody's dealing with their own oppression in different kind of ways and so forth. And then you step outside and now everybody's dealing with that. That's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So we make it a point, you know, you got to have 4 positive touches to everyone negative, even to try to come back from that.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a high five or an attaboy. And there was actually a study done. As a matter of fact, it was done one of the years that the Miami Heat won the championship. And it wasn't done because they won the championship, because the study happened to be done that year. Does it make a difference? The high fives and the shoulder bumps and the pat on. So they actually recorded all these touches on these NBA teams. The ones who had the most touches, they were all in the playoffs.
Really?
And it was the Miami Heat that year that had the most positive touches and affirmations.
That's incredible.
And so it speaks to what you're saying,
yeah,
about the environment. So we're able to do that, and it just take that. And I've seen particularly our youth, you know, urban youth across America be demonized.
Yeah.
They're just so evil. They can't. And I've had an opportunity to interact and experience with them and find out they're the best that all humanity has to offer.
Yeah.
And so
it's a righteousness judgment. It's like a righteous judgment of that.
Right. Well, yeah. And it's even deeper than that, I think, you know, because it's definitely self-righteous for someone to do it.
Yeah.
But it's a whole nother thing for society to accept it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Man. So with that said, what would you say that are some of the biggest things that are having a positive impact in the Liberty City community?
Consistency.
That's huge. Yeah.
You know, consistency. I tell individuals personally, you know, I do a lot of I train athletes, two young athletes, and help them do certain things. And I learned through life that consistency is the greatest weapon that we have.
Yeah.
And we have been able to consistently as an organization provide our community with positive male interaction, with positive leadership, with everything from economics to social realities, employment opportunities, but that whole life transformation. We have been consistent at it.
Yeah.
And we will not stop.
Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be your most powerful weapon is that consistency and just showing up on a regular basis. Mm. I've had this this idea, and I don't know if it's right or if it's appropriate. And it's like what I've had this idea to say, going into to communities that are in these situations, mm-hmm, and training. I don't know why women or matriarchs are kind of a target. Say train matriarchs on doing this type of work, or you know, community organizers or counselors on doing this type of work, and inviting people into the community and creating these workshops to heal, do the systemic trauma healing, mm-hmm, and try to see over a long period of time how the ripple effects of groups of, you know, 2 to 3 turn into 16 to 24 to 100, where the kind of benefit, like where the critical mass,
right,
of, you know, turning the scales over in a community happens.
Right. You're all in our community wellness plan.
Mm.
That has to be a part of it.
Yeah.
I'll put on another hat. Okay, because let's say in the education and the youth development world, some people consider me to be kind of be a guru, just in terms of the way I interact and work and teach people how to work with our young people,
yeah,
and also motivate, inspire, teach, and train our young people. There's been a long-standing concept, and it's one of our plans in the Circle of Brotherhood that's still on the shelf waiting for that opportunity. When you talk about youth, and the biggest problem with our young people, the biggest problem with our young people is the adults that have their hands on them.
Yeah.
And if you look at the fact that you're talking about parents, but you're also talking about teachers.
Yeah.
You're also talking about coaches. You're also talking about counselors. Those institutions are underdeveloped when it comes to know how to deal with that child. We got to understand now in education, it's only been maybe 20, maybe 25 years where if I wanted to become a teacher, I had to take a youth or human development class. That wasn't the case before. Yeah. If I was a biology teacher, as long as I took my biology classes, and then now you throw me in front of a human being that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
So they need training.
Yeah.
They need healing.
Yeah.
It's the parents, the teachers, the coaches, and the people in society who inject our children with their unresolved trauma and their unresolved pain.
Yeah.
So they need transformational training even to learn how to properly work with our young people.
Yeah.
But it all starts with them learning how they have to deal with their own realities.
Yeah.
And lastly, you know, I've had a lot of what I call divine experiences in my life. And I remember I was at an international conference And one of my duties and responsibilities was to play host to these international scientists who do work on material from outer space.
Okay.
You know, so I spent 3 or 4 days with them. And I'll never forget at dinner, this one scientist takes this material that was crumpled up in his hand and he places it on the table and just lays flat out, you know. So, you know, people start picking up, crumpled, lays flat out. And he starts explaining that that material is about 16 million years in advance of anything that we've seen produced. Now, I only use that example to say that's how far behind we are.
Yeah.
At educating properly people into the human sciences of higher mind and life development.
Yeah.
You know, we're so far behind, you know, the American educational system out of the 21 two industrialized countries is like 21.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then when it comes
atrocious.
To human development is not even a part of our core curriculum.
Yeah. It really isn't.
So we're behind.
Yeah.
And the only way to do it, we have to touch the families. That's why those healing circles that take place in the community.
Yeah.
Our meetings actually evolved into healing circles.
Yeah, that's what I was watching some of the videos on Facebook, and I was like, this is as close as, you know, so constellations are, we did, you know, the Zoom constellation, right? So those are usually happen in a circle. Okay. And so you create, it's called, you know, you create the knowing field. It's what it's called. And so there's a concept, there's a theory is that it creates this resonance, right? And so in that circle of people, there's like a collective knowledge in there that you can communicate with people on a more profound level that we can even comprehend, right? And so that's why you can represent somebody and you can say, I feel this or I feel that, or I feel like I need to move over there and whatever that looks like. And when I saw your videos, I'm like, this is as close to these workshops that I've seen outside of that world. And I was like, this is moving in that direction.
Yeah.
And the origins of this come from the Zulu tribe in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the name of the podcast is Zulu One.
Okay.
So there's this full circleness to this that I'm like, this has to have something. There has to be something here.
You know, you give me a flashback. I was 18 years young. I was a freshman in college. And I took a class that was all, I was a communication arts major. I took a class that was called The History of the Theater. And we had a report to do. We had to do some research on the origin of theater and come up with something. And so I did my research and I came across something that was called the Imwindo Epic from the Twa people that, you know, we call pygmies, but the Twa tribe.
Yeah.
And how they, through theater, had passed down traditions.
Yes.
Many healing modalities as well.
Exactly.
You know, and I'll never forget when I got that paper back, it had so much red on it, I thought it was bleeding, you know, and then the words to come along with it. How dare you say the origin of theater had its roots in an African, how could you say this? And, you know, just I'm giving that example,
man.
Because
boy, was that teacher wrong.
right. That's my point.
Yeah.
And so when you begin, you know, Paul Robeson is a great, great, great example. You know, I can talk about him about many different things, but in this aspect of what we're talking about, you know, as an opera singer, he would place African beats and African rhythms.
Yeah.
And people would ask him, why are you doing that? He said, because it belongs there.
Absolutely.
And so healing is a rhythm.
Absolutely.
Just think about it. Even the EKG system, what's it called? The EKG machine?
Yep.
That's a rhythm.
It's got a rhythm to it, yeah.
So life has a rhythm.
Yeah.
Healing has a rhythm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Environments have to be made to have that rhythm.
Yeah.
And so there's always going to be a lot of similarities when that same atmosphere is created.
Absolutely. There's the podcast actually before this is with Jill Peirce, and she's very famous in this world. Her husband is a biologist, an English biologist, and he came up with the theory of morphic resonance. Mm. And but she's on the more on the more kind of healing side of things, right? And she does these things that are called ancestral chants. And so through harmonies of voices, they create something that's more than the sum of all the parts and put in tune everybody into the same place. And they do drum circles. You know, you see that kind of in the healing modalities. And you're 1,000% right, is that it doesn't – the stories and tribes were passed down through these dramatizations and these psychodramas right. of what were happening in systems. And so the constellation does it a lot. It says it's an outward representation of what's happening in the internal world. And you can have profound truths in those things through, you know, the abandonment and healing and bringing back the you know, mother and child mm-hmm. or bringing back the father and child mm-hmm. or bringing back the family system in the right order that it's supposed to be in or, you know, reconciling with a perpetrator. Or reconciling with a group of perpetrators, or you know, no longer holding a burden for somebody else mm-hmm. and giving back that right. burden. So it's really interesting that you did your paper on that because mm-hmm. that is, you know, those stories, the theatrical stories, come mm-hmm. from right. profound truths
right.
that have passed down from you know we're all humans, we're all part of a you know God mm-hmm. or you know Allah right. or you know whatever you want to call the universal power that holds us all together,
right.
and that has. We as a species can tap into that
right.
and connect with that greater power.
So now our job becomes to, number one, remain centered
mm.
in that knowledge.
Yeah.
And to take it to those who don't have it.
Absolutely.
And there are people that you can reach that I could never reach.
Mm.
And there are people that I could reach that you could never reach.
Yeah.
But we have to understand and respect the importance of our work
yeah.
and our reach, because if there ever has been a fallen humanity, we're living in it.
Yeah.
We're living in it.
Yeah.
You know, a little exercise I do with folk to kind of get them grounded back into the reality of a couple of modalities. But one, you know, if I think hell is paradise, I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know, and so I have people just list all the words that you can think of to describe hell. And I don't care who you are. You start writing down these words. Well, let's start looking at it. And now let's look at the world that we live in. You know, you're talking about going to hell. Wow, that's going on right now. Ooh, wow, that too. That. Wow. Everything that I just listed for hell. Right. And then you start listing the things that we want.
Yeah.
Or what we think of as a heaven. And then you start to realize that as we raise our thoughts, mm. that we can gain that right here now. What I love about the constellation concept, first of all, is a personal aspect. I remember being younger in my growth and development into whether you want to call it an awakening or consciousness, you know, knowing that there was some significance in the pattern of the stars.
Mm.
It's not just random.
Yeah.
Not being an astrologist and understanding it and, you know, but yeah. just having a knowing, you know, yeah. and also having a knowing that imprint or yeah. blueprint, if you will, has something to do with us as individuals as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
And when you look at human interaction, every single training that we do is a universe within its own self.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, for example, yeah. we might take 60 young people from all over the boroughs of New York City out to a training in the woods for a whole week. What they're going to experience and go through is universal. And so as we learn how to create those elements,
yeah,
you know, people are brought together for a reason. And then to be able to understand the importance of using what I call in the language valences, they may be called something else in the actual training.
Yeah.
But sometimes our pain runs so deep.
Oh, yeah.
That I can only see it or even deal with it through another valence.
Exactly.
And it keeps me from re-injuring
yeah.
myself as I explore it.
Yeah.
And so I am personally a great big puzzle of individuals who have poured into my life's work.
Yeah.
And I'm a great, great thief.
Yeah.
Meaning that, you know, if it's something that's good for humanity and it works, I'm stealing it. Yeah. I'm using it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as you were describing, you know, the rhythms and all, that's what you see in our trainings.
Yeah.
You see, you even see the chants. You'll see all of those things because they all play a role in creating the necessary synergy and mindset for transformation.
Yeah. Yeah, I was watching. I was watching one of the videos, and you guys say, you guys have like a chant that you say, at the beginning. Like that's. I was like, this is. You know, you guys are going into that systemic field, and navigating that is powerful. You know, having the power to navigate is that.
You know, there's a community really that we worked in, and it's one of those opportunities where you get a chance because we were there for like two solid years, a community in Liberty City, and. To watch the language of the community change.
Mm. Oh, man.
You know, I mean, I'm just keeping it 100 with you. From every explicative you can think of in the world to young children being like, brotherhood.
Yeah.
And so even the language. And so when the language changes, the vibration of the community changes.
100%. You can see it in your language. Like my... You know, I've been doing this for like 12 years, right? I've been involved with this type of work in one way or another for like 12 years. And I have consciously changed and subconsciously changed the way that I talk. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't say things that don't have, you know, openings or softness mm-hmm. to it or create, you know, these judgments right. towards things and create flow with something that I can have these exchanges and ideas and the way that, you know, I even express myself at work, mm-hmm. right? I say when somebody says, "Thank you for doing this," I don't say no problem. I used to say no problem uh-huh. because that's, you know, puts that there's right. a problem. I say anytime. I'm right. always available for you. Like yeah. being at service for people. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you guys are doing that in the community and saying the language, the topology of the language is changing inside of the community is signs of profound change.
You know, I'm smiling because I'm having a flashback again. Again, being at the youth center I talked about earlier. And, you know, most places they put up signs for children and they say, don't run. So instead of putting up signs that say, don't run, we put up signs that said, always walk. When you change the vibration of language, we teach a lot in our core classes, particularly groups that we're able to have for a sustainable amount of time. We're able to have some of those groups of individuals, of adults. In some of our training classes for a good month, 4 weeks. That's their full-time job, is to come to our class.
Wow.
And what an experience it is. But we teach about vibration and language. You know, every word makes a sound. All sound has power.
Yeah.
And the difference between a negative vibration and a positive vibration.
Yeah.
And changing the language. So as I just heard what you described, you've actually become your way. And when we learn to become our way, it's not something we have to force.
Yeah.
It's something that we are.
It just happens.
And it's automatically receptacle.
Yeah.
To others around.
It's huge. Yeah. It's huge. Wow. Yeah. So what, I mean, you have a wealth of experience. How does that transformation look like? What is the first thing that kind of got you down this path of exploring different modalities? Is that through your communications background? Is that kind of where this comes from? Or
started from my life.
Okay.
You know, and I need to say this in first, just to get right specific into it. Everybody in the circle of brotherhood has to play their role. And if there's an expert carpenter or builder, we let he who is best lead. But in this particular work of human transformation, this is one of the gifts of life that I've been blessed with. But it started out with my trauma-filled life, you know, which was a necessary part of my journey. My mother had me at 16. I had a brother by the time she was 17. I had a sister by the time she was 18. Father wasn't on the scene. You know, other things that you can imagine going on. Which if you ask, I'll obviously explore because my life is an open book.
Yeah.
You know, but I share that to say all of those particular traumas that come from what I've been through they play a key role because it puts me in touch with who I've been able to reach. But on top of that, there was a deep, profound desire. I'll never forget when I went away to college, I had this deep desire to come back and talk to high school youth. Because I knew there were things they needed to know.
Yeah.
Who lived where I lived and who've been through what I've been through and who are going through it and that they can make it. And it became so inspiring that it ended up becoming an actual business itself. So that desire. So now you got life experience.
Yeah.
With that desire and that passion. The key thing is now you have to love so hard that you want to master it. Mm. So now you start studying. You know, the whole communications piece was an accidental on purpose thing.
Okay.
I told you earlier when I moved to Baltimore.
Yeah.
I'm in a high school with 2,000 students and I know none of them.
Wow.
You know, and so basketball was a pathway for me. But also I'm sitting in class one day, an announcement. Attention, boys and girls, if you're interested in joining a drama club, report to room 3524. I wasn't interested in no drama club. I was interested in meeting some girls.
Yeah, right.
Honest to God, true story. So I go there in my mind with the only intention of meeting girls. I figured drama club is going to be some girls. Hey, I ended up starring in every major play and production, entered in speech tournaments, winning speech tournaments across the state. I mean, discovering gifts, skills, and talents I didn't know I had.
Wow.
So then going to college, you know, when I was coming out of high school, in my mind, I wanted to be a public broadcaster.
Okay.
You know? I wanted Ted Koppel's job. This is Ted Koppel on Nightline. That was in my mind.
Oh, wow.
So when I get to college, I pursue the communication arts, but my interest is in so many different places.
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm going to take that psychology class. Ooh, that sociology. I like that. Ooh, I'm going to take that class. Oh, the African history class, I'm going to take that. And I ended up being guided to put myself together.
Yeah.
And so so many times in what I call the fool system, we're unguided or misguided.
Yeah.
You have a young child and you ask that child in first, second grade, what do you want to be? They name 15 things. I want to be an engineer, basketball player, tree farmer, I want to be a farmer. And they mean it.
Yeah.
Ask them in the eighth grade.
Yeah.
It's all been depleted.
Yeah.
I don't know what I want to be.
Yeah.
And so you have to find and put yourself together. So I took classes that I had a divine interest in. I ended up getting a sociology degree too, so-called by accident, because I was just taking those classes.
Oh, wow.
Certain professors were both drawn into my life because of me and because of where I was.
Hmm.
Why do I mention that? All of those things are necessary for someone who wants to master something. And then you go deeper and then you become a student. And now I'm a lifetime student.
Yeah.
And I've been exposed to some of the greatest conscious minds of our time. So all of that is the toolbox, but you have to step into an atmosphere first with love and transparency.
Yeah.
That was a long-winded way for me to say that's where transformation begins.
Yeah.
It begins with love and transparency.
Man.
And when people can see and feel your love and know that you're transparent, it creates an atmosphere for them to do and be the same.
Yeah, it seems like the toolbox of the trauma, the communications, and sociology put you on a path with this that is you know, a hand in a glove, right?
It's that, but it's more divine too. I'm gonna go back to college for a minute. You know, I became president of an organization on the campus called the Black Student Union, and when I became president, wanting to be a good servant, I had a meeting with the students. Okay, what are some of the things you all want? Well, there's only 7 black professors. We need more black professors. We want more black students. We need more funding for these. Okay, cool. So what I'll do is I'll see if I can get a meeting set up with the president of the college. So, you know, I call the people and I set up the meeting. Sure. So now the meeting's set up and now I come back to the group. It's about a week away from the meeting. Oh, I successfully set up the meeting. Now, everything I'm getting ready to tell you, it happened with no pretense of thought of anything. So there, I was like, any of y'all want to come? Okay, yeah. So about 8, 9 of them wanted to come. Oh, meet me down at, you know, the quad at, you know, Thursday morning. The meeting's at 10 o'clock. We'll go to the meeting. So, you know, I put my suit on that morning. I got to put on a suit. I'm going to meet with the president of college. And so a voice comes ahead and says, call the media. There's two television stations. I guess it's pretty significant. It's black students are meeting with the president of college. All right. So I called 16, Salisbury, Maryland, and 47. They both show up. So now we got two television cameras and about 10 wow. black students walking across the campus to go meet with the president. Now, mind you, I'm doing this with no pretense, you know, and I get there and, you know, I don't see any issue or problem. And the secretary opens up the door. Her eyes get this big.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a point to this story now. And her, as her eyes get that, she was expecting just me. I didn't call him and tell him I was, you know. So long story short, we end up being in the boardroom with the president on one end, me on the other, and the students and two television cameras. It's probably easy to say that our requests that we made on that day were expedited quite quickly.
Yeah, I would imagine.
But why do I tell that? The following semester, the black professors on the campus went from 7 to 14. And two of those professors played a divine role and my personal growth and development, and my collective understanding of the work I'm doing today. One of them was a social work teacher, Dr. Brennan Taylor. And what I received from that man is just even the way and methodology about looking at human care as healthcare, just so many different kind of things. But I got so much from him that I told myself, wow, I'm getting ready to graduate now. I'll take a class with his wife just because I got so much from him. His wife taught in education. First class I ever took in education and only on that level, you know. And about 2 weeks through the class, she calls me up and says, I don't want you to come to class anymore for this semester. I want you to go do a research paper on the black male child in American education and turn it in at the end of the semester. And it was that assignment and it was that paper that birthed me into my knowledge and awareness of real education and understanding systems of moving human beings from a dead level to a level of transformation.
Yeah.
But I mention that because if I didn't take those actions earlier, those individuals wouldn't be brought into my life.
Yeah.
And who and what they led me to see and become and learn from would have never taken place.
Mm.
And we all have, those of us who have a calling, we have roadmaps.
Yeah.
And we have to pay attention to them. And sometimes we have to make ourselves still enough.
Yeah.
So we can see them. And I'll say this last point.
Man.
I've noticed over the years in this work that what normally might take this much effort and time to get the transformation. Like, wow. So there's something to be said about being in season, about being polished.
Yeah.
And about being experienced in this work and open to learn and to grow.
You hit on a really interesting point is that I have a core belief that all humans have the ability to achieve great potential, right? Mm-hmm. There's just humans have huge potential, and the things that keep them small are traumas. And it seems that the earlier you deal with those things, right, the more prepared you are to receive, or the path is clearer of those obstacles.
Yeah.
Because it's like you have to, if you heal it quickly or heal it at the earliest stage, your path will be full of possibilities rather than doing it. And I think that that's one of the biggest disservices we have as a country is our inability to deal with trauma at an early stage and healing at an early stage so we can get the full potential from everybody.
You know, one of the most successful methodologies that I've been able to use over the years came from a human development concept that I actually picked up at an Islamic educational conference, international conference. And it was a human development theory, as he was explaining it, that was based upon these three stages of seven. Mm. From conception to seven, from seven to 14, and from 14 to 21. These critical mass
stages, yeah,
areas. And there were critical things that children needed,
yeah,
in each of those areas. Of course, multifold, but in this particular vein, that conception to seven, play activity, mm, and how vital a role,
yeah,
it plays into their growth and development and how much they grow and how much they end up,
yeah,
learning.
Yeah, yeah.
7 to 14, now the need, of course, play activity is still there, but now there's a primary need for law, order, and discipline.
Yeah.
And if those two stages are in place, it allows the parent to be a friend or an advisor between 14 and 21.
Yeah.
But thus the operative words, if those two stages are in place.
Yeah.
And so I do this activity called 777. And just giving an example how it works and ties into what you were saying. I remember doing a training program for men and women who were long-time incarceration, now they're coming home. 5, 10, 15, 20. I had one gentleman in my class that was locked up for 39 years.
Wow.
They would spend 3 weeks with me in a class before then going on into the world of work and employment. And one day this guy came to class and he was ruffled and, you know, had just had a fight with his 15-year-old son. Mm. Physical fight, you know. And so he had been incarcerated for, like, I don't know, more than 10 years. So he had been out of his son's life since the age of 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there, I don't know. And you can't come into that child's life and try to bring law, order, and discipline because you skipped play activity.
Yeah.
So I said, look, you got to concentrate on play activity with your son. Whether it's throwing a ball, playing cards, whatever you all do now, that's age-appropriate fun, and build a proper relationship. Most of our trauma takes place early on.
Yeah.
That conception to seven.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so if we can, and so I have people in this exercise, before you graduate from the class, you come up in front of the class and you walk through your 777. And the way you walk through your
Your personal 7-7.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I give mine as an example. And then, you know, you have to be an open book first. So I give mine.
Man.
And the way you do it is you go back to the earliest point that you remember. And then you start walking your way through. What do you remember about play activity between this time frame? You know, and after a person walks their way through, certain things are going to be revealed.
Yeah.
And now those who are participating in the experience, you're allowed to ask questions based upon, you know, for example, I noticed that you went from the fifth grade all the way to the ninth grade. Can you go back and talk some more about, and then now this person's realizing that, wow, you know what? I blocked out that sixth, seventh, eighth grade, and wow, this is why I blocked it out. And now, wow. And so now they're talking about it and it's coming out. I don't have to tell you, it can be a very emotional experience.
Oh.
But I'll close with it by saying, man, I remember we had this one brother. This one brother had been in and out of prison, life of violent crime. And he got ready to do his 777. And all he kept saying is, man, I was just born evil, man. I was just born evil, man. I was evil from the start. I was just born evil. So just walk through your 777. Come to find out, this young man was born in a brothel, so to speak, a prostitute house. And that's the environment that he grew up in. But the more he began to go back and unravel his experience, the more he began to separate,
yeah,
the wickedness of what he experienced with himself. Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Wow.
What's the song? That's the Way of the World. There's a line in the song that says, a child is born with a heart of gold. Ways of the world turn the heart so cold. And I close this point with this. And, you know, so, you know, we get this reputation for doing this great work. So, of course, you know, I'm teaching these so-called gangsters all this and all this. And I make these so-called people, look, think about the hardest so-called most thuggish person that you know. And at one point, all they could say was, So what happened between to I'm gonna kill you?
What happened
in between that space?
Yeah. Yeah, like everybody was born a baby. Everybody, you know, needed mom and dad, and everybody needed some and didn't get whatever that looks like. That's extraordinarily powerful to look at things that way.
And born already with a divine purpose.
Yeah.
And we know we were born with a divine purpose, number one, because we were born and we all have a different set of attributes.
Yeah.
You know, some might have a little bit more portion or a little less of this.
Yeah.
And all of those have been formed. When a life is produced, just as much trauma has traveled down the journey.
Yeah.
With the production of that child, so has the force of life.
Yeah.
Traveled down.
Yeah.
With that child.
Absolutely.
And the idea, you know, one of my great mentors, Samuel Yett, who was a political analyst, wrote a great book called Choice, A Question of Black Survival. He says, anything that can be used to destroy life on the inside of the womb can and will be used to destroy life on the outside.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a lot of the systems of healing that we operate and work within, they're just like the human body.
Yeah, 100%.
So we can recover from any trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it's interesting that you say that. It's like you, in the workshop, you see like people that survived, you know, the Holocaust or, you know, the Russian-Romanian War and, communism or, you know, Cuban, you know, like just horrendous atrocities, and they're able to reconcile those things and said, oh, I was sold when I was a child. Or, you know, I was, you know, sold to men, you know, whatever scenario that is. And then they're able to reconcile those things and come to a place that it's not a place of everything's better now. It's a place of that's what it was. I'm here now. And I'm no longer tethered to the patterns and the dynamics of the things that happened in the past. And that's like, the earlier you can get to that place, or even get it to a mother that's going to have children or a father that's going to have children, you can start having the gatekeepers hold the space for the generations that are to come. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I've got two kids, right? I've got a 7-year-old and I've got a 4-year-old. And my wife and I are both, you know, on this path of working on working on my shit, right? Mm-hmm. That's basically, work on your shit, man. Mm-hmm. Just all you got to do is work on your shit. The hardest thing you got to do in the world, but just work on your shit. And you can see it in them. I'm like, oh, I just got to give you a clean slate, man. Life is hard enough that I'm not going to burden you with my garbage, right? Mm. And that's the thing. It's just say, I'm going to be the gatekeeper for all the crap that happened in my life or happened in my parents' life and all their stuff, and just give you a clean slate so you can have the best chance for success or reach your full potential or your divine destiny.
You know, one of the things that was revealed through my own 777 exploration was the hatred that I developed between the ages of 7 and 14 for men. And particularly my father as well, and black men, because those are the ones in my environment for the most part. But of course, obviously that was injected into me, not knowing it. And so we carry those things, as you say. And I have 6 children, you know, from they span the age from 27 to 9.
Yeah.
And, you know, when my children were little, I would sing songs to them.
Yeah.
And one of the songs I would sing is this African family song in Swahili. And you would put family names in the song and sing about the person, you know. And so one night I'm singing the song and one of my children says, say your father's name. And so my song went from this great, you know, me, me, I'm a Pinzi, I'm a young girl. I love my family. It went to, You know, and then at the end, one of my children asked, said, Daddy, how come we don't know our grandfather?
Mm.
And then that's when it hit me that if I don't heal from my personal pain and hurt with my relationship with my father, I'm actually teaching my children indirectly that it's okay when they have children for them not to be around granddaddy.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't around our granddaddy.
Yeah.
So not to say that we corrected daddy mediante. Yeah. You know, we really did.
Yeah.
You know, and I have this one particular picture that kind of symbolizes it for me. Well, first of all, when I was five, my father bought a fishing pole for me. He never lived with us, but he bought a fishing pole for me that, you know, never used. You know, and I remember when we moved out the house, you know, my mother said, just leave it right there. And I remember how mad he was we left it. We like, well, he never took him fishing. But, you know, about maybe three years ago, you know, we're having a little family reunion in Martha's Vineyard, of all places. And he's out there fishing with my son. You know, healing.
Mm.
Full circle.
Full circle. Yeah.
You know, and then once we able to face those pains, you know, they are painful at the initial invasion of that space, but it's so healing to begin to allow it not to take a hold on your affairs.
Then
eventually you can laugh at some of that stuff.
And that's why at the meditation at the beginning, it's like connect with your mother and your father, even if you didn't have a good relationship with them, even if you didn't know them. Thank them for bringing you into this world, because without them, you wouldn't be here. Just for that. And just being in the act of gratitude from that point is life-changing. Mm-hmm. Saying, thank you for giving me life. Whatever happened, happened.
Right.
You know, just honor you, you know, honor thy father and thy mother, you know, just for giving you life. Mm-hmm. And if anything else, I'm here because of them. And then creating the generation behind that and and bringing in the excluded ones. Mm-hmm. And say the life force of all of you and all the experiences that you had before have cascaded into me. Thank you. That's it. It's like, wow, man.
We carry a lot of load. That was very well said, too. I appreciate the way you described that. You know, I'm also reminded of a mentoring session I was doing at a school not too far from here, I would imagine. And there was this young lady who had her book up, her head down, you know, and I've done this work for a while, so I give people space. You know, our teachers are horrible at that.
Mm.
Horrible. Yeah. That's a whole nother topic. But and so, you know, I give people their space in that environment, you know, and continue to go on. And then others are wondering why, you know, I'm not even giving them space. And then, so, you know, my first approach is after a while I come over. And when I came over, it was written on her book. There was a quote, and it said, people don't build walls to keep people out. They build walls to see what people are willing to do to get inside.
Wow.
And see, we have become, one of the most wicked things about this great country we live in. Have no question that it's a great country that we live in, but one of the most wicked things is the way it has dehumanized human development.
Yeah.
You know, we're taught to be so cold and so callous, and we're even trained to be so methodological in terms of our approach to our own stuff and other, you know, it's a horrific thing. That's why this work that we do is so important.
And it's so scary to the establishment.
Yeah.
Because the establishment wants to keep the kind of the status quo, right? And that's why there's a reason for it, and it shows us the way of resistance, right? The more the resistance is, the more you're going to say, this is the path that I'm going to say. Like, you know, one of the things that happens when you go to a workshop is like your life will throw you everything not to go. They'll be like, you know, your car won't start and you've got a flat tire and your kid is, you know, woke up crying, and it just give you every single excuse to be like, I'm not going to do this, because the system has the self-preservation that wants to stay the status quo. And what the most confusing thing out of it is because out of loyalty to our family, out of love and out of loyalty to our family system, is be like, I am so big and I am so me that I'm going to take on this burden for you, for my family, for my father, for my system. Is like, I'm going to be, and it creates.
It's enabling.
All the dynamics that we know. Mm-hmm. Diseases, abandonments. That's why, you know, friends, you know, like, hey, man, you're dating the same girl over and over and over and over again. You're in the same relationship, in the same situation. You did the same thing that your parents are doing. There's a reason, and it's out of loyalty to say, I love you so much, family, that I'm willing to make the same mistakes and commit the same patterns to be able to belong to the system.
And that's personally and socially suicidal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the healing part comes where you know, there's these in the work, there's these like rituals that you do, and you like literally, you know, kind of give back something to a parent. Said, thank you for giving me life. Mm-hmm. In your honor, I will be successful. Or in your honor, I will choose life. Mm-hmm. Or in your honor, I will choose to, you know, let myself be loved. Mm-hmm. Or I'll choose to not be in this dynamic no more. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful thing about this. And the things that you're doing in your work rhyme so much with all of this. It just kind of fits in this kind of very, you know, it's a song that rhymes, you know?
Well, I mean, because it's the same work.
Yeah, it's the same work. It comes from the same place. Yeah.
It's the same work. You know, I remember, well, you know, people say it all kinds of ways. The easiest way I've heard it said is that, you know, if you're trying to get to 7, you got a few different ways to go. 4 plus 3.
Yeah.
That's 7.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
8 minus 1.
Yeah.
That's 7.
Yeah.
You know, what are all the 8 minus 1s going to look at the 4 plus 3s like they're crazy?
Yeah.
Because that's the world that we're produced in.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll say this, and if you want to probe more, you can feel free to, you know, our people, particularly meaning Americans.
Yeah.
We become so arrogant.
Yeah.
Or arrogated,
yeah,
in understanding educational systems,
yeah,
that we have dismissed some of the greatest giants,
yeah,
that the world has ever produced,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and some of our job is to continue to learn from those giants,
yeah,
and make it digestible,
yeah,
because look, even if you don't like good food, if you're eating it, it's going to have an effect on your system.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and absolutely. So I am content only that I know that good will always triumph over evil.
Yeah.
And you made me think of earlier, well, wow, what are the ingredients of healing? If healing was a cake,
yeah,
this is a cake called healing. What has to be in it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's absolutely.
You know, and as we talk about those different ingredients, even after we get all of the ingredients in, we still got to bake it.
Yeah, exactly.
And how many of us want the cake before it's baked?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And that's kind of some of the things that I'm fearful of with the new social movements that are happening is that castigation of the outside rather than saying like the assumption of responsibility and saying, I'm going to judge and castigate and, you know, with my righteousness, create a perpetrator dynamic as me identifying as the victim. And that's so scary. It's like some of those, that dynamic, you know, systemically has created the largest atrocities of that we've known to man.
Right.
You know, when you look at like Soviet history, it's like them, us. Them, and it's, you know, they sent millions of people to die in these camps. You know, it's just, that's when you see that castigation of the other, and instead of it's us, we're all us. Mm-hmm. This thing is, you know, the police versus the person that gets beat up. We're all part of the same thing, representing different things in those dynamics. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for me to say, you know, in this podcast studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but, you know, it's right. Not in being participating in that mm-hmm. dynamic, but we have to be smarter than that and say, we know that the system has these players in play. Let's heal the system rather than mm-hmm. castigate it or judge the other.
It takes time. You know, I smile as I listen to that now only because I know the outcome.
Yeah.
You know, I was at it was a community rally shortly after the death of George Floyd. And we were asked to be in the environment. People asked us to be in the environment a lot because we're peacemakers. Mm. We keep peace.
100%.
And in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And there was this young lady. She must have been about 19 or 20.
And I think she air show is kind of happening.
Yeah, I see it. Is.
Oh, the F-16.
Yeah, I get to see it.
That's so cool. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I got you. And she's so distraught at the end.
Yeah.
Because she didn't get a chance to read a poem. She's 19. She just had this awakening. And she had a poem. It was a very beautiful, divine poem. And she felt like she had to share it born at this moment if it doesn't get shared now. But I smiled because we all have an introductory point of becoming humanized or becoming more demonized.
Yeah.
And no matter where we are at that introductory point, it'll grow.
Yeah.
So I'm not concerned anymore about, say, people's shallowness.
Yeah.
And they're approached because they're approaching it from where they are.
Yeah.
And if they stay in the water long enough, you know, they're going to grow.
Yeah.
And so the success of us as an organization has come from our willingness to continuously grow.
Yeah.
It's come from our willingness to continuously serve and love. But we understand that excellence and training are part of that growth and development. Yeah. Once we can get human beings to have that fierce or that tough conversation, the dialogue will continue on in their head.
Yeah.
I've never met a human being that didn't want transformation.
Yeah.
I met many who weren't ready.
Yeah.
But never one
that
did not desire
it. That didn't want it. Yeah. Man. No, the example that you guys are setting is just really astonishing. It really is an example that the country needs to follow. You know, to say the vulnerability of being open to grow is the most powerful thing in the world. You know, just to be in the arena. You know, as Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, it's not the critic who counts, it's the man in the arena. Mm-hmm. You know, face marred by blood and sweat. Is you're in the being vulnerable and having the courage to have that vulnerability. It's just. I don't know how else to express how in awe I am of the power that you guys have in that aspect. It's just it's inspiring, really, to do that.
You know, I tell you, you're making me flash back at what I've seen as we built this circle of brotherhood. You know, and to see men laugh with each other, cry with each other. Mm. Counsel with each other, be stern with each other, support one another, and be disciplined and trained to want for your brother what you want for yourself.
There's
a scripture that ties into what is going on with the circle of brotherhood, and I think it's I read scriptures from many different books. This particular one is from the Bible in the book of Malachi, and it talks about the hearts of the fathers turning back to the hearts of the children. You know, the world has done a pretty good job at demonizing, particularly black men, as people who abandon their families and who have abandoned their children and have abandoned their community. We're rewriting the history on that.
Yeah.
Not that there wasn't always that element there, but because it's being done now in such a fashion that we believe we have a model that can be duplicated in other places.
Yeah.
And what makes it most successful, again, is we come from all walk of life. You don't see you don't see Muslims working together with Christians in the real work. The way you see us doing right now. You don't see guys from the upper echelon of businesses working with guys who are straight up from the streets. But we have all of those dynamics.
That it really is something to be applauded, that it's just this organic grassroots thing that's happened, and it's inspiring. It really is inspiring. I don't know how else to say that, and it should be applauded at every single level, because it's the only way that this thing's going to succeed. It's the only way we're going to get out of this situation, and it's a model that should be replicated across the country. It's putting everybody together in the same room and exposing the vulnerabilities and healing those.
Right.
And saying, hey, let's get to this. Let's fix this shit, because if it's not, nobody else is going to do it. And there's a quote that I really like. It's like, what happened to you is not your fault, but it's your responsibility to fix it. It's like, come on, man. You know, nobody else is going to do it. Yeah. We're going to continue to do this thing over and over and over again. It's not your fault what happened, but it's your responsibility to fix it.
You know, I'll say this lastly on that too. And I won't identify the individual or the community, but we invited an individual from a marginalized community to come to one of our police trainings. And this individual came to the police training, and he was like, wait a minute. My community needs this. We might have a different set of stuff that we deal with, but we got to deal with. This could help us do it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you start looking at, we're in a position, because, you know, these different communities would never be in each other's presence.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But now understanding that we have this.
Yeah.
And so, yes, the world is on its way to hell in a rocket ship, but it's also on its way to heaven by means of the men and women that do the work.
Yeah. And it's ripe with opportunities as well. Like, there's just these, I'm just kind of blown away by the world of possibilities. This conversation that we're having is just, I've been, you know, kind of looking forward to this for years, to saying, how can I get in a space where we can have this conversation and put it out there and put it out into the ether and see what comes out of it and heal the systemic trauma start to begin to have the conversation about the systemic trauma in communities. And going back to the slavery aspect, until we start talking about the systemic traumas and the patterns that are in, you know, that are from descendants of slaves in the United States, we can't start healing it. The systemic patterns of abandonment, trauma, abuse, and every single aspect. And so we start saying these patterns are patterns that come from 30 generations ago, 40, 50 generations ago that are happening in the United States. And until we start saying, oh, this is part of something larger.
Right.
It's not just individuals making decisions based on their community dynamic. This has individual component to it, but it also has a larger systemic component to it that can be addressed and healed on a large scale.
It can. And I think one of the critical factors is actually two of the critical factors that hide that reality is that the ignorance that we have to the origins of slavery, the ignorance that we have in race relations, the ignorance that we have on the compounded interest of undealt with trauma.
Yeah. Compounded interest of undealt trauma.
Yeah.
That is a very good one.
Yeah.
Man. Know,
that's what it is. And it's all covered and protected by law and policy.
Yeah. Yeah, the establishment wants to keep it.
It protects
us. Yeah, of course. Of course.
You know, and so we got to deal with that aspect, but then we also have to deal with the aspect of true acceptance.
Yeah.
You know, in dealing with slavery, there have been many, not enough, but many documentaries, so-called movies, series and put together. But 99% of them, it's the oppressor telling the story of the oppressed. And so there has to be room made for proper dialogue.
Yeah, space. Yeah.
You know? And then there has to be room to accept truths that might be other than our own.
Yeah. And to look at the dynamic softly without judgment.
Right.
You know?
Right. And see, that's the important
thing. To look at it softly is to carry things like you carry an egg. You know, not, you know, not with, it takes a lot of time.
And as a facilitator, you have to understand and give room to somebody who is carrying it.
Yeah.
Like they're going to crush the egg.
Yeah, exactly.
Who is, but you have to understand that's where they are.
That's where they are in the path. Yeah.
Right. And if we accept people where they are.
Yeah.
Even, you know, somebody asked us the question about our police trainings. And to be honest, I don't even remember his name, but the officer that had his knee on the neck of George Floyd.
Yeah.
Somebody asked, well, do you think your training, you know, could have transformed him? And my answer was, whether it would have or not, it would have exposed him.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could be safe to assume that he's got some trauma that he hasn't necessarily dealt with, right? Like that comes from a place that it's like the openness and vulnerability to be that there's a place that comes that creates that ends in that scenario.
And here's a dangerous thing though, because you could have cases where that comes from his personal trauma, but there's another avenue of a collective trauma.
Yeah,
when you've been brought up.
Yeah.
To fear.
Yeah.
Black people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not even know that you fear them.
Yeah.
When you've been brought up. See, because that's a whole nother trauma that when it becomes a trauma on a societal level.
Exactly.
It produces murderers and killers.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I get to the point where I fear you so much.
Yeah.
Then my mind becomes instinctively that not only are you an enemy of mine, but I got to deal with you.
Because it's the otherification of the person. You know, it's you dehumanize them and other them.
Right. And I have a personal stance because my society has taught me this.
Exactly.
And so it must be true.
Yeah.
You know, I have been raised and reared in this.
Yeah.
And now I'm fed the images.
Exactly.
That, you know, so I have been, you know, I guess, Eric Fromm, you know, he talked about being sane in an insane world.
Yeah.
And that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about human development today and you're talking about healing and dealing with trauma. You're talking about the roots of slavery and cultural isolation today.
Yeah.
Then we are sane.
Yeah.
But living in an insane society.
Exactly. But the good thing is that we have a roadmap to deal with it. It's like no time has been better than now to with social media, getting the information out there, that, you know, science has caught up to epigenetics of symptoms, that systems understanding of systems on large scales have come to say, okay, there's some patterns here. Mm-hmm. Even going into to technology, right? AI is like there's this ghost in the machine that puts things together. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, if the things of that system translate into the real world, you can start seeing the patterns of – there's this guy. His name is Nicholas Christakis. Mm-hmm. And he did a TED Talk on – I might be butchering this. Mm-hmm. But he did this on – it's like spouses that pass away. When they're like a husband or a wife that passes away at long term. Exactly. Yeah. So it's like a 50% rate that the person, that spouse can die, you know, in a short period of time after somebody dies, right? But they said that the system around that person, so like best friend, child, you know, cousin, you know, brother, sister of that person also has an effect. And so there's like this systemic intelligence in this cluster of data that's happening. So imagine that on every single side of every single system, because we're not only, you know, human systems, we're our gut has biome, you know, we have an endocrine system, we have a circulation system, we have a reproduction system, we're part of males, we're part of humans, we're part of, you know, our society, Miami-Dade, South Florida, the Western Hemisphere, and then planet, and we go on to system to system to system, right? And there's so many sections of that that we can say, I'm, you know, I'm a male that used to be in the military. Now and I'm an entrepreneur, and then I can do the. And so I'm like, what system am I talking from now? And what system am I reacting from now? And that's interesting what you brought up with the Floyd, with that case, is like, where was he coming from? With what inherited trauma? Of what system was he coming from to create that scenario? And then the compounded, you know, interest on trauma, what you were saying, is like produced this atrocity, right? This horrendous situation, this horrific
right. And scenario. The thing about it, you know, and then I you know, of course, I had to do a lot of interviews, you know, after that. I kind of made it clear to folk that there's no difference in terms of that particular action pre-George Floyd and post-George Floyd. That is continuing to go on. Mm-hmm. Children and families are being abused. It's continuing to go on.
Yeah.
Spousal abuse, all these type of traumas,
continuing to go on,
they're continuing to exist.
Yeah.
You know, and so we got to make heaven out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was seeing the jets fly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was pretty cool.
It was.
I didn't I didn't realize that the Fort Lauderdale Air Show was happening today.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
Until I saw those four planes, like.
Yeah. When I was in the military, that was like the best gig, is to work the air show.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd just be like, you know, working the air show, and, you know, you'd have access to everything. It was pretty cool. Yeah. But hey, man, I just wanted to say thank you for coming. This has been really amazing. I've just learned a lot, and it's so cool how much this, you know, kind of relates to each other on the conversation. It's really, really, really powerful.
Well, we have to be very, very thankful for you. You know, I tell you, you know, there's a lot of MVPs in the world. You know, one thing I know for sure is that the message and the exchange and the sharing that we did today, it'll be beneficial to those who catch it just because of the vibration of it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you for your stance, because I have to be quite honest. There's not a whole lot of individuals that are willing to have the necessary conversations. There's not even a whole lot of individuals, either black or white, you know, that are willing to talk about the root causes of our trauma and the role that slavery has played into it, and those kind of things.
Yeah.
And so your willingness and your courageousness, it was a book called Fierce Conversations, just being able to have those.
Yeah.
Come to find out that we have more in common than we realize. And I want to thank you as well for your edification of the work of the Circle of Brotherhood.
Yeah, it just, I'm really in awe. And you know, like was, you know, people in the law of attraction world say like attracts like. So like the similar minds are, and this is just simpatico and at many levels. So, you know, I really appreciate what you guys do and you coming out here today. And I know this is, I still can't believe I'm still trying to pinch myself, because it seemed like such a far world away at the beginning of this thing. And now, you know, I consider you a friend, you know.
Likewise.
What I mean? It's like, it's really cool to kind of build that relationship out of this thing. And, you know, keep at it is kind of the lesson of this whole thing. It's just like, keep at it. You'll get
keep
to somewhere,
right.
You know? And so, just for people out there, how can they get a hold of you? Get involved? What would be the website, or is there?
Excellent. You know, and I tell everyone, first of all, the very first thing you should do is to go to the website, www.circleofbrotherhoodmiami.org. Okay. Circleofbrotherhoodmiami.org. Contact information, everything you need is right there on our website. If you live in the area, feel free. We're located at 5120 Northwest 24th Avenue. Appropriately named the Dr. Dorothy Bendros Mendigo Social and Economic Institute.
Awesome.
And so that's where we can be found. Again, www.circleofbrotherhood.org.
Okay,
and,
perfect.
My name is Brother Lyle Muhammad. I have the honor of serving as the executive director of the Circle of Brotherhood. And we're open. We're open to anything that can make our communities a decent place to live.
It's been really a pleasure having you, and it's been a world of understanding, and how much you know, we've come together on this thing and how related it all is. And it's really, really powerful. Thank you very much.
It is definitely the next wave of education.
Yeah, exactly.
We're out in front.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Mine.